Happy New Year to everybody. Successful year to some of you, and less successful to those from other political parties, but nonetheless a good year at a personal level. Okay, originally we had one item on the agenda today, and that was to deal with the amendments that were coming back to us from the NCOP in terms of the National Land Transport Bill. Okay, I think that we all know that we ourselves had requested those amendments. What was at play there was that after finalizing the bill in the this committee last year, when was that just? It must have been about October.
I think like August.
August, okay. After a long, quite a complicated, difficult call, we had finalized the bill, and we were working under a lot of pressure. And everyone else was working under a lot of pressure, including the state law advisors. And it seems that the state law advisors failed to reflect all, particularly I think it was consequential type amendments in the version of the bill that went to the House. We picked that up on the morning of going to the House, and we took a decision to let it go to the House so that we could get it to the NCOP, because we were on a very tight deadline for the NCOP. In terms of giving them the space to deal with it. So we said, let's just pass it, knowing that there would be a chance for the NCOP to then deal with it. And we asked them specifically to deal with those items. In the course of that process, let's hold on to that. Just to say then, the second item that we've decided rather late in the day, that we must actually use this opportunity of meeting, is to address the crisis around the bus subsidy issue. It's been rumbling for a while, and it's really coming to a serious head now. And there are all kinds of parties that were wanting to come, and I thought maybe the best entity to ask to do a presentation, and the one that might be the least suspect of raising the issue for private profit motives and so on, was the union, FATAL. And they have prepared a presentation and have been active in it. So hopefully they will be here shortly, and we will get around, just hear a presentation from them and get a better understanding of what is happening, at least from their perspective. We very late in the day informed the department that we were doing this, and they haven't got anyone from that section of the department to then provide us with an update from the departmental perspective. But I think once we've heard from Tatao and discussed the matter and so forth, then we can decide how as a committee we want to move forward on that matter. So those are the two items, and I apologize for the belated decision, but I thought it was really important that we couldn't allow a deep crisis, okay, just to rumble on and not use this opportunity to deal with it. Okay, so those would be the two items.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that. Relating to the bus subsidy issue, is this not sub judice at the moment? There is a case currently in the courts, and I would be loath to start going and delving into some of the issues there until such time that we see what that says today. I think it's sitting, or tomorrow.
Yes. No, I certainly don't. Yeah.
And I would also appeal, Chair, that I wasn't prepared for this. I thought we were going to do this. Hence, you know, because of the fact that we didn't meet previously, our caucuses, I think in most of the smaller parties, I don't know about yours, are meeting today at 10 o'clock. I mean, at 12 o'clock, sorry. To discuss items like this that need to be, you know, getting mandates from that caucus for presentation to Parliament tomorrow or the next day. There's quite a few bits and pieces like that. So I'm just giving you the logistics of some of that, and, you know, providing that time frame is going to be looked at, because this could be a lengthy debate from what I can see. That's bust up.
Okay. Let's start with the legislation piece. I thought that we had agreed as this committee that there were some anomalies. I mean, the position, I think, I noticed there's further documentation from FATS and so on. What we're going to recommend on that is we take note of what they're saying, but there's no way that we can now entertain further amendments, because then it has to go back to the NCOP or to mediation, basically. We haven't got time, and we'll lose all of the work that we've done, because once this Parliament closes and we go to elections, then all the legislative work we've done on the NLTB becomes new, you know, it kind of falls off the thing, and we have to begin again and risk, therefore, exposing it to all kinds of things. We definitely know And the department also is beginning to signal that there are some further amendments, and I think that I have a suspicion, and it's not for us to say, but certainly I think what we should recommend is that the department look very early on in the term of the next parliament to an amendment bill that picks up on some of the smaller things. But I think really, I hope that our political understanding across parties here is that we've done really well, and we were in strong agreement as across parties in this committee in pushing through that bill. We've changed the architecture quite fundamentally in law. Let's capture that. Does the DA, for instance, need to refer back to the caucus? Because this is we're where we were back in August, basically.
The issue relating to that SASA amendment, I think, was on the table. And in particular, there was a report and recommendations that was set up by Gisa, who was the then deputy president, for this task team. And I'm just worried, you know, that we have missed something here, because if we agreed that we would have a look and let it go through a process of the NCOP where they would, at the province, address those issues on the ground. Now, what I want to know from the department is that why didn't they pick up then and try to get the thing sorted out? Because it's clearly, you know, an issue.
Okay.
I mean, we've got a World Cup coming and tourism
let's get into the meat of it in a moment. I was just discussing the process, okay? So what you're signaling to me is that you're not necessarily ready today to sign off on what's come back to us on NCOP, okay? So I'm hoping that we'll persuade you, and that we'll persuade you, but I'm not assuming that we've persuaded you, but I'm hoping that we can persuade you that we can formalize and agree to the amendments that we've requested from the NCO that come back to us, and that we work out, therefore, a set of recommendations to the department about how to take forward other matters. That's what I'm hoping, okay? But I'm not assuming that will... Okay, so can we leave that to the process just now? So at the moment, we haven't got going yet. We're just trying to signal what are the two items on the agenda, okay? And then secondly, what we're hoping to do. And you're saying my hopes might be in vain in terms of being able to settle the NLTD because there are a couple of outstanding things. Okay, point taken, and let's leave that to the process. But can we agree that we will now begin with the NLTB process? Let's get a report from the department, and then let's see where we are. Okay. And part of where we are is that we don't have a quorum in any case, so that's also something we're trying to attend to. Lenny?
No, Chair, I was saying it's agreed. Let us start with the business and see how far we go. And the other members also join us, and then we'll see how far we get closer to the quorum. And also expect that as we are debating, maybe the DA may have a different view of what they're having by now, after we've debated.
Okay, so welcome to the topic. Welcome back.
Okay. Chairperson, I'm Jit Patel, Department of Transport. I deal with the Integrated Transport Planning Section. With me, I have Stephen Shalang, he's also in the Planning Section, and Takalani Dandoleni, he deals with legislation. And we have people from the Ministry as well. We have Grant and Dion, and we have Neville Dingle, he's the service provider assisting the legal aspects of the bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Chair, my name is Mongameli Kweta from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. The documents we are going to use to take the committee through are two of them. One is B51C. That's the document that was put together by the state law advisor when the bill went through the NCOP.
It's 51C down on the bottom left-hand corner.
So I was looking at the... 51C, yes, on the left-hand corner at the bottom.
Down at
The sin. Okay, man. And then we will, relate it to the bill that was passed by this committee and the National Assembly, that was B51B on the left-hand corner. B51B. Those two documents have to speak to each other.
Okay, what we've got is the D version.
The D version is what it's a composite of the amendments that are now in D. Yes.
Okay, that's what we've got.
Okay. Shall we just bring with the D?
I think we'll be on the
top. Okay. Chairperson, I'm going to ask our legal service provider to take us through the B51C. There are many technical aspects as well as quite a few, I think, facts that cross references as well.
Thanks, Chair. If we refer to the T version, it's virtually all just changes of cross-references, grammatical things and so on. To start off, these references in the C version refer to the B version, and these changes have now been incorporated into the D version. So, for example, if you start at the top on page 2, on page 2 in line 27, to admit special division, these are changes to the headings in the table of contents, which were incorrect. So, for example, if we look at the B version, page 2, line 27, or if you look at the table of contents in the D version, just after clause 16, there's a heading. This is the reference to 16 in the table of contents. There's a heading, institutional arrangement, special division in municipalities, which has now been changed to institutional arrangements, municipalities.
Okay. As far as I'm concerned, that's fine. You're just giving us an example rather than
laboriously
going through every single one, unless members want us to address. These are all just cleaning it up. Lemis, you wanted a point?
No, I was saying Jefferson is a heading, and that's why it's, I think it's not supposed to make any meaning. That's a guide to the document.
All of what we're dealing with is of that order, basically.
Okay. Thanks, Chilin. So the first part are all just headings in the table of contents. So. In clause 1, these are all cross-references that have been changed. And then if we look at item 12 there under clause 1, in the B version, in the definition of subsidized and subsidized service, there was a piece that was put into the wrong definition by mistake. If we look at the B version, on page 8, the definition of subsidized service contract. The second half of that definition, where services are subsidized for any other reason, that should have been in the definition of subsidized. So that has now been moved. It's now under subsidized instead of under subsidized service contract.
Okay, since we're going to deal with it, let's just have a look at the bid. And we don't have fees, as a
are we looking at page 8?
Page 8 of the D version.
D for Donald. And we're looking at the definition of subsidized.
Yes. And if you look the second half of the definition on line 35, it says always services are subsidized for other reasons, for example, to encourage public transport usage, relieve traffic congestion, to support land use and traffic integration. That is now correct. That piece was previously under the definition of subsidized service contract, which was an error. So that error has now been fixed.
Okay. It's just a chunk of things that we like to be said in the definition, but placing it in the right place.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, then item 13 on page 2 is remember that all references to transport authorities were removed. Participating municipality, that definition was relevant to transport authorities, so that has been removed from the B version.
Okay. But in the B, there was a definition of participating municipality. We don't need it.
Yeah,
correct.
In clause 2, then, we're now on page 3 of the T version. There were some changes that were made by this committee to clause 2 that were not reflected in the B version. I would suggest that the committee have a look and see if you're happy now with the way that clause 2 reads. It previously read of the transport system to complete the process of transformation and restructuring the land transport system. That was a duplication, and the committee suggested that it be moved because it's there already. And the word policies was omitted in one of, just tell you where that was. In C, the word policies was omitted. That was decided by this committee at that last meeting.
Yeah. It is difficult to follow without this P version.
It is difficult.
It's proving to be difficult to follow. Thank you.
Because the references in C are to the B version.
Okay, I can read what the B version said in that regard.
Remember what is here, what our original B version said on this matter. Let's just get a sense, a strategic sense of what we're dealing with. I mean, we're deep to all of this. This is all our more accurate
statement made by this committee, actually.
Now, more accurate statement. Really, what we're doing is just reminding ourselves. It's a bit of a refresher and orientation.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So
I would suggest that we just highlight a few issues. I think that's what we're doing. So I think an important thing, probably not that important, but important, is the purpose of the Overall Act, which is thought to of the 51D. And basically, we've seen that by, and then it's not that yet, like we need to follow. We can try and help it.
Yeah, I'll just read what A used to say. To A said, to further the process of transformation and restructuring the national land transport system, to complete the process of transforming and restructuring the land transport system initiated by the Transition Act.
Okay.
That
and
was
our concern there was the word complete was very ambitious and too final. This is a complex transitional process, and we're taking it forward in this act, but we don't claim that this is now the final. That is what we're saying, which is why we preferred this slightly more modest but very important statement.
Yes.
Furthering the process of transformation of infrastructure that was initiated in our Act. Okay. That was certainly an energy made. And I remember several of us in that final claiming that this is not the final thing. I'm sure exactly the type of thing that the students have to raise and that you're going to raise will tell us that it's not final. There's going to be ongoing work. So that's what we're just saying.
Okay. In C, it needs to read to prescribe national policy principles requirements, and we decided to remove the word policy.
Right. So it's there in B. Yeah. We're giving effective national policy by prescribing principles requirements. meeting.
Is this okay, the way we think?
See, the next thing is in clause 5 sub 6, which I think is on page 10 of the new version.
Yes.
Yeah. You'll see it says, when a province or municipality cannot or does not fulfill an executive obligation. Now, it used to just read, where a province does not fulfill, and there was an identical clause in 7 sub 3, which said, where a municipality doesn't fulfill. So just to tidy it up, this 5 sub 6 has been changed to read province or municipality, and the other one's been deleted.
Good.
Just to tidy it. Then in clause 6, transport authority has been deleted. And in the third item there, we inserted a definition at some stage of regulatory entities. So instead of saying the National Public Transport Regulator and all the others, we now just say regulatory entity. It's clause 6 in the D version. These lines refer to the B version. Yeah, but I'll just tell you where it is in the new version. It's 6 sub 5, which is on page 10. 6 sub 5, it's line 47. You'll see it says by regulatory entities. It used to list them all and say the National Public Transport Regulator, provincial regulatory entities, and so on.
So my mind was still locked up on clause 5. The manner in which it has been crafted on a province or municipality, it says to me that we must ensure that there are clear mandates between the province and municipality. Because if there is no real clear mandate between the two, then it may pose a problem to the minister. Where the minister wants to intervene, then either the province says, no, we have not failed, it's the municipality that has failed. Or if it's on the basis of the province and the municipality say we have not failed. I just want us to ensure that we have got a clear mandate on provinces and municipalities, and just we seek to see that particular clause and just ensure that there is no gray area between the two, so that if the minister wants to intervene, then it should be clear that the relevant authority has failed, that is mandated to do that specific activity. Thank you.
I'm not sure, Chair. This principle was in the original version of the bill, which has now been approved by the NCFP as well, that where a province or municipality fails to carry out certain executive obligations, the minister can intervene. All we've done is combine the two clauses into one. They say exactly the same thing. But I'm not sure if I'm following it.
There's not, I think, Leonis, if I understand it, and he'll correct me, is saying that this also might have to do with the relationship between a province and the municipality on how they're called. But it may, but it's not specific about that, but it may also have to do with that. And therefore, if you say, yeah, is it? Is that the nature of the question? In other words, often it's unclear whether the municipality or the province has failed. There's a failure sometimes. Unclear who's failing. Therefore, there needs to be clarity sometimes.
And often it's unclear who's failing because it's not clear whose actual responsibility it is, clearly. All of which may well be true, but presumably the answer to that is, yes, that may be true, and that's why we are trying to more clearly define roles. But all we're doing here is saying that in any other sphere of government, on an executive responsibility, the minister has the right to intervene if there's a failure. That's all we're saying. How he or she determines there is such a failure, all of those things may well be complicated in reality, and hopefully we are helping that process by trying more clearly to define who has what responsibility. Is that an okay answer?
Yeah, the chairperson, you have captured it correctly, because my understanding was that these particular clauses, as we provided them on the original document, they have been in relation to particular mandates in those specific sections. You had one particular clause that was flowing from a particular mandate and the other one, but now we are bringing them into one. Now what I'm saying is that we just need to watch out that there is no grey lines between the province and the municipality, because if the minister intervenes on the basis that the province has failed, whereas a particular metro thinks it has not failed, then it may create a problem. So we just have to watch that there is a really clear mandate, that we don't have grey lines. Then just look for that particular provision and just simply advise us on that. Thanks.
Chairperson, in regard to that, if you look at clause 11 on page 13, it deals with the responsibilities of the three spheres of government. If you recall, that is where we delineated, spent quite a lot of time there. And if you look at the A is the national, the B is the provincial, and the C is the municipal sphere of responsibility.
Okay. Just while we're there, since we've had a look, there seems to be a grammatical, if you look at the D,
it's worth picking up, line, I think it's 23. Appropriate on page 10, that sub 6 that we've been looking at, subsection 6. Clause 5, subsection 6, we say, minister may intervene by taking the appropriate steps to ensure the fulfillment of that obligation. It should read obligation. Okay, it's minor grammatical. But if we have time, just to correct that. Okay. So it's not a big thing. Okay. Okay, anything else you want to just...
The next thing is H1L, which is on page 11. In line 28, the national information system, it used to read national traffic information system, which was correct, which was wrong. So we say the word traffic has been deleted.
Okay.
And these are, the next two are just grammatical things.
Okay.
And indentation. Here at the top of page 4, still in clause 8, if you look at the sub 2, starts on line 9 of page 12, before making any regulations, the minister must publish a draft. That clause was decided to be included by this committee, and erroneously it was not included, so that is now being put in.
Okay, remember that well, and thank you for
remembering to put it in. That was very much stakeholders raising that point, which we agreed. Yeah. We don't get whimsical regulations. Okay?
Yeah. Then the next few things are grammatical or transport authorities. Just checking through. Clause 17, the heading, grammatical. Clause 20, Chair. This is another, these are other clauses that this committee decided to put in that were omitted. It's on page 17, 18. You see the 3 and 4, the prescribed quorum, those are clauses that were supposed to be included. Then we've got, Chair, you'll remember that designated planning authorities was changed, so all references to those have been modified. Clause 23, which is the provincial regulatory entities, it was decided in this committee to delete the not more than 4 so that we don't limit the MEC when appointing the committees. So that's been deleted. That's on the top of page 19, clause 23 sub 2. The next thing is in clause 28. There was a mistake there. Looking at 28.1, see which one it is. In B, it says they generate the movement of passengers. It used to say generate the management of passengers. That was just a typing error.
Yes, we prefer
the word movement to management. Next one is clause 29, sub 4, which is in starts at line 47 of page 20. This was a clause that one of the stakeholders wanted in, as it was agreed to insert. Then we've got transport authorities again, grammatical things. Trying to see. In clause 56, we've got the regulatory entity instead of listing them all again. Clause 77, license or permit. Then clause 84. Sub 4. The National Public Transport Regulator may impose conditions that previously said that must be relating to sound systems, air conditioning, and so on. And SATSA wanted that out, and this committee agreed to remove all the detail. It is a bit bald at the moment. The National Public Transport Regulator may impose conditions. We're on page 40 in line 33 now.
Page 40, line 33.
Yeah. 84 sub 4. It now says the National Public Transport Regulator may impose conditions. Now, that was as decided that all the detail that followed it should be taken out. It's a bit bald at the moment. Maybe one should say when accrediting an operator or certifying a vehicle would be better. But I think it is basically okay.
Beautiful. I would urge us not to.
Then the next ones are all basically grammatical. Up to clause 93, which is transitional provision. If we look at 93 sub 5, it's page 45, line 15. This is a clause that was in the original version of the bill, somehow disappeared, but it is needed as a transitional provision that any existing transport authority will cease to be a juristic person on the date to be determined by the minister, and those municipalities must amend or restructure the administration. It's just a needed thing for transport authorities. Yeah. I think that's basically all. Yeah. Sub 1's gone out, which is not necessary anymore. It dealt with the pro forma founding agreement for transport authorities. That was a consequential change.
Yeah.
Not necessary anymore.
Let's move on to anything else. Okay, let me.
93. 93, that new sub-clause.
The one we've just been dealing with.
That's now, yes, this is sub 6 or something
yes,
like that.
Yes, any transport authority, that's right. Yes.
Yeah, it is open-ended, yeah. the restructuring of the administration in line with this party. It just says as soon as possible.
Yes.
And there is no real certainty.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether we're not going to find ourselves sitting with old structures for 2 years, 3 years, and people claiming that no, they don't have capacity or resources to comply with the new, and you find that you can't determine. I'm not sure it's whether it will be okay like this. The possibility is that the new act may be undermined on other good reasons of not complying with it, which we may understand. Yes.
First of all, we're dealing with one existing transport authority, one metro.
Ignored the national transitional act. So that's the first issue. The second issue is presumably if we try to set it, if there's a failure to do that, then the responsibility rests with the minister, because the minister, we're empowering the minister to set a date. We could say, or we could have said, because I'm urging us not now to try and re-say, we could have said within 12 months or something, or 6 months or whatever, of the enactment of this legislation. But that might be unrealistic, because you do want a deadline to be realistic, so that you don't give it, in the middle of 2010 preparations, maybe it's advisable not to try and do a whole institutional restructuring in Etiquini, but to allow the 2010 thing to happen and then focus on institutional change. So I think you want the minister to exercise his or her mind about the matter, but also to have the power to say, what are you doing? You're stalling for not good reasons and so on. So I think I think what we've got here now is the right way to go. It must happen. If there's some attempt not to let it happen for bad reasons, the minister must have the power to set a deadline for it. But it should be, and we're dealing with one metro. We're not dealing with hundreds of transport authorities. Stuart?
I read like that, because once the minister set a date, and he's determined that, there's a process that has to go on now. And in that process, he could actually even say there that as of such and such a date, they are non-juristic, but you have so many months, weeks to wind this thing up, which is as soon as possible, as I see it. I know it is a bit loose-ended, but I think within that, the right we've given to the minister here to do that, or whatever, that directive could be in there.
Yeah, Chair, what I'm reading here is that the minister will actually set a date of the end of the transitional arrangement. But then the restructuring, it doesn't say that the minister will determine that, when it will be completed. It only says after the minister set a date where this transitional arrangement stops, and then the transport authority or the municipality, whichever is doing, was on the transitional arrangement, then would adjust in terms of the new act as soon as possible. That's what I was reading. But if one hopes that the minister will also determine, it's the possible date on which they should have restructured, it's fine. But I was not reading it yet.
So that's what it is actually doing right now. Any transport authority that may have been established
and that are currently in existence will cease to be transport authorities. But it's a transitional arrangement, because obviously there are all kinds of salaries and funding and budgeting and so on, so it can't just be done from one moment to another. But at the same time, you want executive power to be able to keep a watching brief on it to make sure that people aren't stalling for the wrong reason. Okay, all right. Okay, so that's basically a kind of a bird's eye view of things, reminding us really of where we got to and what got left out inadvertently in the rush of a very complicated piece of legislation. Okay. Now, numbers of other things, so that I create the space for Stuart or anybody else, because I noticed, for instance, we've got documentation that's been which I'm aware of, which I got personally through the email, say from SASA, which is the South African Tourism Services Association, raising some concerns and suggesting some further amendments to the legislation. Okay. We are aware that there was also a NEDLAC process, for instance, and there were hopes for some kind, and I'm saying this because I'm not going to play them in on this one, but I mean, just to say, it's not just that, a number of other entities. The department itself also was trying to push through some further amendments into the NCOP, because in practice we're running into not huge problems, but niggling things that's where we could certainly make improvements. The NCOP didn't have the time and space to get proper mandates and so on to digest any of these further amendments, but very willingly agreed to accept the amendments that we've just looked at that we wanted to see. Okay. But, so can I make a proposal, which is the following, which I've been flagged, which is, can we please today, if possible, agree to accept these amendments that we wanted that have come back to us from the NCOP as agreed? That's basically our agreement. Can we accept them in this committee, and we're now sitting with a quorum today, so that tomorrow we can take it to the House and we can sign off then on the National Land Transport Board. In so doing, I think this committee should make a little report, and I think we've got 5 minutes for someone that's allocated to me, but I won't be available, but someone like Lemius, who could as mandate Lemius across parties to say that we're happy, we thank the NCOP and everyone else for all the work that they've done and all the contributions made and so on, and this is now the bill, and we think we've done good work. So I think it's a major architectural change to the transport thing. However, reality always is a great teacher, and even as we've moved along, we're aware that there are numbers of things that require further consideration. And there's definitely a strong argument for an amendment bill to this thing being introduced as soon as possible in the next parliament. And we as a committee would like to recommend to the department that that should happen, and it would embody the NEDLAC processes, it would embody your own experience and concerns, and any other things that might be drawn. I mean, whether these are legitimate or other concerns is not, you know, it's not something we're not talking about what the content might be, other than that we know that this can be improved. But if we miss the boat now, then it's back to scratch. And let's remember that I think we did very well, and the department did very well, in getting this past the provinces, i.e. past the NCOP. Because in effect, what we're doing is we're potentially taking away quite significant powers away from provinces in the interest of getting better coordination. And basically, and this is a 2010 thing as well, it's not just 2010, but it's a critical 2010 thing, but getting that integration in the host cities between the planning, the regulation, the subsidies, all of that, bringing them into one space and not be fragmented, which has been a big problem. So with its shortcomings and so on, it's imperative that we get it through and not leave it to the chance of a new NCOP with perhaps a different balance of forces and so on, and they reject the whole thing. Then we're really back to, then we lose what we've got. Can I urge the DA to adopt that approach?
I have no problem with this, and I don't think I have any hassles. I think we should, in our report, table the concerns that have been expressed, because I think the whole objective that I understood behind this really formation, it's called, of these operating licensing boards, was to make it more practically and more generally smooth, you know, smooth out the long delays that are taking place there. It's the biggest constraint we have in the whole industry, whether you're a taxi operator on the one side or a bus operator on the other. And we've really got to address that, Chair, and I think it's got to go into our report very strongly that thing has got to be on this agenda for the new Parliament, ASAP, in order to be re-looked at and taken into consideration the practical implications on the ground. That's all I want to say. And I think that if we can get that assurance from the department that they will do that, then let's get this thing out of the way. It's so important now. It's running into 499 days.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, I think we are definitely happy as well that we are getting the necessary support, and also we would like to move in that direction, that we get this thing off there tomorrow. And then with the report that you are suggesting, that needs to be tabled in the House. I think we are happy and we are supportive of that proposal. Thanks.
Yes, we are happy, we are supportive of the old move.
No,
I wouldn't actually oppose, because honestly I wouldn't be very, very conversant, but I would support it because I would have no reason to object.
Thank you.
Have you got the copy?
Yes, I gave you one.
Oh, thanks. Sorry, sir. You gave me one. Why are you shouting? This is Patel, eh?
Yeah.
Okay, groovy. Okay.
As I said at the outset, but maybe not everyone was here, there's a big problem that we're all aware of with the bus subsidies. There's a court case which and an appeal, I think, again, which is Golden Arrow. So we'll be careful. We won't dive into sub judice matters and the detail of that specific case. It would be inappropriate for us to do it while it's happening today in any case. But what we do want to try to do is to try and get a better sense of... get a perspective on what is happening. And one of the many stakeholders are obviously jumping up and down and are desperately concerned, including the department. And so we thought that maybe a good place to begin, although we should have begun ages ago on this matter, would be to ask the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union to do a presentation. They've been very active in this matter. So Jane Barrett, Jane Stephen, I know it's Jane Barrett, but I see your email is Jane. Okay, so Jane Barrett, who heads policy in the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union, and her comrades have come along to do a presentation. So welcome and thanks for making yourselves available. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Comrade Jeremy. And thanks to the committee for indulging us today. I'm here with Ivan Abramsa, who's our provincial secretary in the Western Cape. We had hoped to bring along some bus workers, some bus shop stewards, but the short notice meant that we weren't able to arrange that. But our interest in this matter is obviously as representatives of a large number of bus workers in the industry, as representatives of transport workers generally, but also as an organization that represents the public interest in public transport matters. We work closely with commuter organizations, and obviously our members, other than our bus members, are public transport users. So we really come here with a broad range of interests, and we are very, very concerned that we, by the end of the week, if this problem of the payment of bus subsidies doesn't get resolved, we're all going to hit a major, major crisis. And every one of us who is involved in one way or another in the transport industry, including yourselves, is going to have egg on our faces, because the public will be the people who suffer most. At the moment, the situation is that government owes 1.2 billion rand to the bus industry in subsidies that have been promised not out of the goodness of government's heart, but through contracts signed with the bus industry, for the purposes of the bus industry providing services. And the non-payment of that 1.2 billion is putting at risk 26,000 jobs immediately in the bus industry, and the access to public transport of 1.5 million passengers who currently use the subsidized bus sector. And those are just the immediate impacts, never mind the impacts on suppliers and so forth. And so really our request to address you is to alert you to this very serious crisis and really to appeal to you as a committee to assist in putting pressure on the executive to get them to pay what is owed to the industry by law. So that's really just to headline the issue. We brought with us, I'm afraid, only 20 copies of the presentation. It's a written submission, and if there is a shortage of copies, hopefully we can get some additional ones made. And you know, hopefully there will be time for you to ask questions of us before we leave. But as I said, the crisis is reaching a critical point in the course of this week. And if government doesn't pay up, the only options available are either for the industry to effectively double their fares, which of course is no option at all, given that the users are largely poor people who are already using beyond the government targeted maximum 10% of household income on public transport fares. So the option of increasing fares is simply not an option. So if the money is not forthcoming, what will happen is that the services will be withdrawn by the bus companies, and those bus companies effectively will go under. They are already 3 months, they're already 3 months in debt, as it were, because the subsidies haven't been paid over by any of the provinces since November 2008. And what is happening this week is that SABOA, the Bus Owners Association, is taking the Gauteng province through with its NECs of finance and of transport cited as the individuals responsible, as well as Treasury and the National Department of Transport have all been cited as respondents, and they are being taken to court this Thursday to ask the court to order that the subsidies owed be paid up in Gauteng in the first instance, and then should the court order appropriately, then the request will be for that order to be extended to the other provinces. What is happening in the Western Cape in regard to Golden Arrows is related, but it's slightly different, in that Golden Arrow took the Western Cape government together with Treasury and National Department to court in late December, but there was an out-of-court agreement which became an order of court that government would pay up, but now government hasn't yet paid up, and Treasury is in fact arguing that it shouldn't have been a party to that agreement. So as I understand it, and we haven't been fully briefed on the Golden Arrows thing, but Golden Arrows is going again to court to get an order that agreement of December be honoured. So that's just the headline issues, but let's just step back a bit and look at who uses our buses. And here I'll talk to the document ahead of you, in front of you. This is paragraph 2. If we look at the commuters who use public transport, and remember, of course, that there are a lot of commuters who use their own private cars. In fact, the statistics show something in the region of 30% of all commuters use private cars. And then there's a proportion of commuters who walk, some who use bicycles and so forth. But of those who use public transport, i.e. who pay to catch a taxi, a bus, or a train, 21% of them use buses. And the indications are that that figure is growing substantially and has grown substantially over the last 2 years, particularly. The reasons for that are partly that more people are using, proportionately more people seem to be using public transport because of the spike in the fuel price in the course of last year, but also because of congestion and other sort of factors that are pushing people out of their private cars, but also because the bus industry is slowly improving in its service provision. And also, of course, simply because the population is growing. So the recent growth in the bus industry is good news. It's good news for the industry, but it's also good news for the economy generally.
And the environment.
And the environment. Because it helps to reduce air pollution, congestion, and, of course, to take the pressure off the cost of building and maintaining roads, which are used so highly by private cars. So, you know, our perception or our view is that this growth in the industry should not only be welcomed, but it should be celebrated and supported and encouraged. And when I go on to talk about the contracts, you will see that there have been certain constraints caused by blockages in implementation of government policies. So if those constraints hadn't been there, we would have seen even more growth. Notwithstanding that, the growth that we have seen in the bus industry should be encouraged, instead of which we're seeing this artificially created crisis through the withholding of subsidies to the industry. Who provides the bus services? Well, most bus services, as you're probably aware, are owned and operated by the private sector. And there are only 4 municipal bus services left in the industry and a handful of scaled-down, provincially owned bus services. We as SATAL, we are still of the view that state-owned bus services should be grown, that municipalities should increase their stake, and that we should halt the process of disinvesting by provinces. But that's really another matter. The situation we're dealing with at the moment is one in which the majority of companies are owned by the private sector. Just as an aside, I should say that we've been very involved in the process with the Department of Transport in developing a BEE charter, broad-based black economic empowerment charter for the transport sector. And there is a subsector charter that deals specifically with the bus industry. And the ownership profile of the bus industry has begun to change significantly through not only the pressures that the new BBB charter is creating, but also through clauses in the contract, which have for some years now required racial transformation in the industry. So the perception of a predominantly white-owned bus industry that in some quarters still persists, it's not entirely true of the reality in the industry. To go on to describe the contract system as it exists and the subsidy system as it exists, the private companies that are contracted have contracts, 3 different types of contracts at the moment. There are what are known as the tendered contracts. There are the interim contracts and the negotiated contracts. Now, no new tendered contracts have been signed since 2001, and I don't really want to divert our attention into the reasons for that, except to say that there have been tremendous problems in the provinces in managing the tender system, and there have also been problems, some of which have been as a result of objections that we've had as Labour to elements of the tendered contracts. There have been problems around the absence of protection for employees covered by tendered contracts. Be that as it may, the majority of the newer contracts have been signed by the National Department of Transport as interim contracts, and it's been partly linked to the delays in the changes in legislation, which you finally completed today. So it would be true to say that the bus contracting system has been in some state of flux and something of a hiatus. However, that doesn't mean to say that the contracts have been illegal or wrong or in any way ineffective in supporting the delivery of service, because the contracts, all of them, whether they be interim, whether they be tendered, or whether they be negotiated, are tight legal documents which have requirements for accounting for numbers of passengers, numbers of kilometers, and so forth. Each one of those three types of contracts are the calculations for refunds from government are slightly different, but nevertheless, irrespective of the type of contract, there are very strict terms of monitoring, of auditing, and so forth. And while there have been instances of fraud and instances of manipulation of the system, we would argue that by and large the system is reasonably watertight. And I make this point because there is clearly a perception on the part of officials, particularly in Treasury, that the industry is, for want of a better word, milking government. And we would really like to refute that. There are tight contracts in place, and if there are problems in monitoring and auditing, the problems must lie equally with government as they do with the industry itself. Now, the revenue from operations and from fares in these privately contracted bus companies covers between 40 and 60% of operating costs. The balance is covered through the injection of funds by government through these various types of contracts. And what that means is that without the refunds that are provided for by the contract, the bus companies simply can't exist. They can't deliver the services that they've been contracted to provide. Just to point out also that the profit margins in the industry are not huge. In tendered contracts, the profit margins run between 5 and 10%, and in the interim contracts, the evidence suggests that there's slightly higher margins of between 7 and 15%. And we know that because we fight for wage increases in the industry. and you know we demand disclosure when we have wage negotiations on an annual basis through the bargaining council, and the industry in its employment of total of over 30,000 bus workers, 26,000 of whom are covered by these interim and negotiated and tendered contracts. The wages of the workers in this industry are not high wages, and it's a reflection of the cost structure and profit margins of the industry. There again is a perception, and has been a historical perception, that the bus companies are, you know, big fat cats who are milking commuters and government for that matter. But I think, you know, the evidence doesn't actually support that view. Clearly there are some companies that are more profitable than others, and to be frank, our view is that the ongoing pushing by government of the tendered contract system has in fact been a major undermining factor in the viability and profits of the industry. So we believe that the system has actually perpetuated the reliance by these companies on fairly hefty subsidies. But again, that's not the issue that we want to raise with you today. We believe it's an issue that needs to be dealt with in the medium to longer term, but the key crisis issue at the moment is basically about the non-payment of monies that are contractually owed to the industry. Who are the workers in the industry? As I stated before, there are approximately 26,000 who are employed in the subsidized section of the bus industry, but there are an additional at least 6,000 workers, and probably more, in the unsubsidized services. There are some companies who operate both subsidized and unsubsidized services. There are some companies who operate only unsubsidized services, and there are some who operate only subsidized. So it's quite difficult to get a completely accurate figure as to the numbers of employees in the subsidized sector, but our estimate is around 26,000. As I said before, this is not a high-wage sector. The entry wage is 2,570 Rand a month. How many of you could live on that? Supporting a family, probably a wide extended family. There are, of course, some workers who, because of long service and because of the positions they, the particular jobs they hold, earn more than that, but that is the entry wage. And I should add that this week, wage negotiations are due to begin with the industry through the bargaining council. But the prospect of reaching any kind of wage settlement in the current context is absolutely zero, unless there is some resolution of the crisis. I should also add that there is currently a shortage, would you believe, of all vehicle drivers in this country, heavy-duty vehicle drivers, both bus and truck drivers. And clearly, the uncertainty of the industry is likely to create uncertainty amongst drivers in particular, but also amongst the skilled artisanal staff who do a lot of the support work in the maintenance of buses. And if the crisis continues, it's likely that those people will jump ship from the industry and go into the trucking industry and into other sectors. So, you know, the knock-on effect of even a withdrawal and closure for a week or two could be huge additional costs in recruiting workers back into the industry and retraining or training new entrants. The next point I want to deal with is where did this crisis come from? Has it just come out of the blue, or has it been known about for some time? Now, the truth is that between Treasury and the National Department of Transport, it's been known for some years, in fact since 2004, that the National Department of Transport was running into a deficit situation in relation to the subsidies. Since 2004, the National Department has been appealing to Treasury for an increase in its baseline allocation of bus subsidies. In 2005-2006, the National Department started to experience a shortfall, and this amount has now escalated to 1.2 billion rand. As we understand it, the shortfall is not as a consequence of the National Department overrunning its budget. It's as a consequence of a refusal on the part of Treasury to pay the money that was contractually written into the obligations of the National Department. And let me try and explain. There is a degree of flexibility in the contract. The interim contracts make provisions, they work on a formula based on passenger numbers. And if the passenger numbers go up, the contract says that government will pay the adjustment in terms of the increased passenger numbers. By the same token, in the tendered contract, there is a degree of flexibility in terms of kilometers. Now, the tendered contracts have got less flexibility than the interim contract, but both of them also have a degree of flexibility around fuel costs and other fluctuating supply costs, because you can imagine you can't, in this world where fuel costs, for example, are varying so much, you couldn't fix the amount of money to be paid in terms of the subsidy. You couldn't just fix it in March and keep it fixed for the entire year. You would have to allow for some degree of flexibility. So, as we understand it, the problem has been created through the flexibility problems and fluctuations in costs, kilometers, and passengers, and the denial by Treasury to pay up that difference between the baseline subsidy and what has been required through the fluctuations. That's our understanding of the crisis. Now, why is it that Treasury has been refusing? And again, as we understand it, and it's not a secret, Treasury's reasoning is not a secret, that Treasury has been trying to put pressure on the National Department of Transport to speed up the implementation of the Integrated Transport Planning System, the ITPs that are referred to in the legislation that you've just been dealing with. They've also been using the withholding of funds to put pressure on the National Department to increase the number of tendered contracts as opposed to interim contracts. Now, our problem with this and Department of Transport would obviously be able to speak for itself, but I think they would, this is their argument as well, is that A, there has been some progress, but there have been delays caused by a whole multitude of factors, some of which have not necessarily been totally in the hands of the National Department of Transport. So the attempt by Treasury to put pressure on the National Department has been somewhat unfair. But that's not really the point. The point is, does Treasury actually have the right to withhold funds where government, through its various spheres, the National Department and the provinces, has entered into contracts with providers? And our answer to that question is that it doesn't have it morally, and it doesn't have it legally, and it doesn't have it constitutionally. So I'm afraid it's inescapable that Treasury comes out of this thing as the bad guys, using and trying to manipulate the allocation of funds in order to bring about an unrealistic pace of change in the industry. So we are completely convinced that the Treasury is doing this both illegally and with an agenda that basically undermines the intent and the letter of both national transport policy and all the legislation that supports that policy. And the officials who seem to be doing this in Treasury are doing it from the perspective of no background in public transport policy or implementation. What are the options available at this stage? Well, as I stated earlier, many of the affected companies will either have to close, probably by the end of this month, which means the beginning of next week. Some companies have already indicated they don't have the cash flow to pay wages for this month. Many of them are living off bank loans, and the banks are beginning to put the squeeze on them. They're saying they're not willing, particularly in the current climate of the whole banking system, to continue to bankroll the company's shortfalls. Some companies have already stopped selling monthly tickets and are forcing commuters to buy weekly tickets because they are nervous about sitting with monthly tickets that they've sold, that they then won't be able to deliver the service to meet the tickets. Some of the suppliers, we heard yesterday that Sasol has given notice to Putco that it won't continue to provide diesel as of the end of this week, because they're no longer willing to have a backup of credit, and so it goes on. So we really are hitting the wall, and something has to give before the end of this week. And we certainly, when we supported the SABOA action in court, when they first gave notice last week, we were assuming and hoping that Treasury and the National Department of Transport and Gauteng Province would come to the party and basically settle the debt. But all the indications are that they intend opposing the action on Thursday, which will mean that even if ultimately there is some engagement with the intent of reaching some kind of settlement, it may already be too late. So unless something gives before Thursday, we're going to see upset workers, we're going to see upset commuters, and it's going to be highly, highly embarrassing for government, because the question that will be on everybody's lips who does any business with government is, can government be trusted to meet its contractual obligations? and you were talking of 2010 earlier, what will it say to the construction industry, for example? What will it say to anybody who's going to be providing a service for 2010 or any other services for that matter? So on that note, we as Sital would really like to appeal to you to do whatever you can to bring pressure to bear on Treasury to pay what is due to the bus industry and to do it before Thursday. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, let's open it up to, I've also great faith if colleagues from NDOT want to make some general observations, but as I said at the beginning, they are not the colleagues who are directly involved in this side of things. Okay, Lynn and Stuart.
No, Chairperson, just before we move forward, I just need to be clarified. I'm not sure whether I've heard correctly. Are you saying that Satau is supporting Sabua in the court action against government? Is that what I've heard? I just need clarification on that one.
Yeah. Chair, through you, we're not a co-applicant, but we have put in a supporting affidavit. We are also publicly supporting the action because our members and we believe the public are generally affected by this. So we have a direct interest in the court action.
Thank you, Chair, and Joan, thank you for bringing this thing to our notice. I think certainly from our perspective, we'll be very conscious of this and have been trying to deal with it in our own way by questioning the minister, etc. But the big issue here, as I understand, is that for the past 4 or 5 years, this has been a continuous problem of funds that either are run out or they haven't budgeted sufficiently for. Now, I can understand the dilemma that Treasury faces here in the sense that they can't continue just to bail departments out when they haven't correctively budgeted for the position that they stay or the money that they want to expend in this particular area. It's a growing market, and we would support any initiatives into this public transport sector. But the bottom line is also this, that the minister is on record in saying that taxis are also part of the public transport system because they commute in 60% of our commuters around the country. And those taxis that get recapitalized are eligible for the same subsidy. Now, I don't know whether the department has got any idea what the extent of this means and what, in fact, is the implication of having to meet these contracts with an open-ended rising population of commuters going onto these buses. It's sad to say that I think, you know, in reality, you know, having to go to court now to force government to possibly pay up is the only option that I can see is open, and hopefully, you know, even if the court rules in favour of the parties here, it's going to take a while before this money even flows. And that is the reality. I think, you know, to say that Treasury is the people that have to come to the party, I think should be put squarely in the department's hands and said, why didn't you make provisions knowing that for the last 5 years that you've been running into this difficulty of not meeting the level of subsidy that we all going to have to put into this industry. I mean, it's an international trend for this type of services to be subsidized. Now, is it not the reality that we have operators here who are also seen, I might add, to be corrupt in the system because it's open to this number of fares and claiming systems, and we've had indications of this, and we've seen indications of it, where everybody is cautious to the sense that they're now thinking that they all charge with the same brush, possibly, and that at the end of the day, we should now be looking at maybe subsidizing the commuter and not the operator, which is the correct way to go, universally. And we've been saying this for years, I might add, that, you know, it's ultimately, when we have this integration of all our public services, there is only one way that we can operate, and that is for the the poorest of the poor, the workers, to be able to get a ticket which will allow them to move from one service, public service operator to the other on a multi-ticketing system. And take away this onus of trying to go and pay out operators, you know, who run. They charge what they have to do. Basically, it's on a redeemable ticket. They get onto that bus, hand the ticket over, and the operator then knows he's got an ability to go and claim that thing. And I really think it's the system, number one, that's wrong. And I really think at the same time, the actual the insight of the department in trying to project this issue to the, you know, into the future is such that it's been done very badly. And, you know, I don't know, with municipalities now trying to do a lot of this type of thing, I really believe, Chair, we're going to have to, as a committee, maybe go down and start focusing a bit more on the realities on the ground there, because it's a disaster, absolutely.
Okay, I'll go rebutting some of that myself in a moment, but
okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a very serious issue. And first of all, the system is open to abuse by unscrupulous operators also. But the actual fact is, the reason for Treasury has the union or the operators interacted. What are the reasons given by Treasury for not paying? Because they had paid right up to November 2008 and the sudden stop. One would have to find out exactly why. And we go. But the unfortunate thing is that it's the commuter who's suffering at the end. And we're having a strange relationship where the commuter and the bus operator, who are two different entities, will end up with the same problem. So they're going to look for the support of the man in the street. Whereas when things are operating nicely and well, and they're getting their subsidies, they completely disregard those people. And those are the people who now will have a case to go and put, and once immediately that is settled, they must. So I'm saying in short, the operators need to support, to do their job properly, and give a service which is needed. I did an exercise in Durban. I went on a bus, I went on a taxi, the combi taxi, and I went on the ordinary taxi, the taxi which is not, and from town to the airport. And I was shocked. I was sitting in the back seat, and this taxi was chop, was jumping up and down and that, and it was the most uncomfortable ride. But no one, even the traffic inspectors, don't even stop those cars. They go for the combi, who is running around. And then and that is also completely overloaded at most times. And the bus service, but you get in, and you watch an elderly person get in. As they get into the bus moves. And push, got to run forward to the back of the bus. And I say it's completely inhuman. And I think we need to look at these things also while we're settling these things. But the main course now is to get those subsidies and to get everything back on track. Thank you.
Thank you very
much,
Jack. And now I come to Jack. Thank you,
Chairperson. I listened to the presentation and I seem to perhaps look at this thing from a different perspective. There is no doubt that buses are doing a good service to our commuters. That is irrefutable. Nobody can refute that. And according to what I get from the presenter, this committee should intervene. I mean, that's the sense I get, that they want intervention from this committee. Now, I think we should be saying, how are we going to intervene? Do we have all relevant facts? One, we learned Treasury is prepared to oppose the case. We don't know why they're prepared to oppose the case. Two, contracts were made. We don't know who made contracts. We learned Treasury was saying they could not have been a party to the contract, and so on and so on. And I think that's where we end. Sadly, there is a court case on the 29th, 3 days to go. This is the 26th today. So I think the 26th today. 27th. 2 days to go. Now, how soon is this committee going to intervene? How soon will this committee be getting all the facts from all the other people? Because we have got to... I don't see us judging immediately what who is wrong and who is right. And please, I'm saying nobody can refute the fact that the buses are doing a good thing. Nobody can say buses should not be subsidized. But I think I've got a problem that I don't have relevant facts, you know, to exercise my mind on all this.
Lemir?
Yes, Chair. We really take cognizance that the debate we are having, of course, is on matters that are sub judice. But one thing for sure as government, we cannot and we should not find ourselves engaging in activity that will eventually run the bus industry under to an extent that people lose jobs, and especially when we are facing the Confederations Cup some 6 months or 5 months down the line and the 2010 next year. But on one side, Chair, there is still uncertainty on my side to really get clarity whether the government is refusing to pay the bus operators 100% or there is money that is being paid to the bus operators, and the explanation I've received, the non-payment is in relation to the variable cost in terms of increase in passengers or kilometers. I just need clarity because I have not received clear cut whether it's a complete stop of paying the bus operators. And I thought that the explanation I received, it looks like it's in relation to the variable component of their revenue. If one can get clarity on that, I think maybe it will assist. And also just simply to raise one point, Chair, that the presentation has touched on some of the things that should be dealt with as we move forward, which impact on policy. But it was just unfortunate that through this presentation, there was no mention of the taxi industry. Absolutely no mention. Even though whether it's being referred to for future purposes or interim. And one would expect Satao to be reasonably progressive also to try and really raise the bar on the taxi involvement in the whole subsidy scheme. Chair, on the basis of the explanation that maybe I'll receive on what component or what is the total tariff that's not being paid, probably one will be able to determine a particular conclusion.
Okay.
Thanks.
Does the department want to say something at this point? Okay, let's hold.
Let's try and break the things up a little bit.
Rather than get a whole comprehensive thing. So let's start with that question that Lemia is asking. But first of all, let me say that obviously, given the crisis and given also the fact that we've not been meeting properly, you know, because we've been in recess and so on, Ideally, what we would have here would be Treasury, the relevant people from the department, not that you're irrelevant, but you know what I mean, the people engaged in this from the department. SABOA, SITAWU, and any other unions that might be active missing, and so on. That we should, that ideally we should have all of them, should have got them all here. And so I'm mindful that obviously we're getting, I hope, an objective, and I think, believe we are, a bit, you know, pretty objective view, but obviously things have been said about other parties, like Treasury, for instance, who are not here. And therefore your point is correct, that we mustn't barge in as a committee, making assumptions about things without having heard all the key players in the thing. We did try to at least get the national departments, the relevant people in this sphere, to come in, and with such late notice. We're facing a crisis, clearly, and that I don't doubt. Whether the crisis has been exaggerated by operators for their own reasons, maybe, but it's a crisis nonetheless. Okay, and I think the nature of the crisis will be underlined by Jane's response to Lemis's question. Is payment continuing? It's just that extras and inflation-related extras are not, or is there a seizure of payment? If you could answer that to begin with.
Yeah, maybe if I could just try and explain. Perhaps I confused you a bit on this. What I was trying to explain is how the department, as we understand it, got into a shortfall. And it was over a period of time. Now, there are mechanisms, as we understand it, interdepartmental mechanisms that work through Treasury, whereby when there are shortfalls, not through overrunning of budget, but through anticipated fluctuations, whereby departments put in for supplementary funding, and Treasury declined that supplementary funding. What that meant was that at the end of November 2008, the Department of Transport said, we have run out of subsidy, no more payments to anybody. So no provinces, you see, the money flows Treasury, national department, then to provinces who then pay the operators.
Who are the contracting authorities, by and large.
Right. The provinces are the contracting authorities. So the provinces are saying to the operators, we can't pay you 1 cent since November. And in fact, there's correspondence from the DG of Transport to SABOA, the employer association, in November to say, as of the end of this month, there will be no payment because the money is not there. So, in fact, since the end of November, no money has been received by the operators. And it's compounded by the fact that in some provinces, including Gauteng, not even November payments have been made, even though the province received their allocation for November. So what that means is that, and the contracts are very tight. There are timelines. At the end of each month, the bus company has to submit a form which fills in, depending on the nature of their contract, whether it's a kilometre-based or passenger-based. They have to fill in a form within, I think it's 7 days of the end of the month. And then the province, within 14 days of that form being certified, because there's a process of checking the validity of the claim. Within 14 days of the validity being checked, the operator has to be paid. And that's what it says in the contract. So that's legally binding. What the provinces have said, and that again is in writing, certainly in the case of Gauteng, is, sorry, operators, in writing, we can't pay you because we haven't received our money. We will continue to process your forms, but we're going to send them back to the department nationally for them to deal with. So, you know, it's a circular thing. So that's a bit of a long answer to your question. But the answer basically is that there's been no money transferred since November. And what that means is that in the case, for example, of there are three companies who are co-applicants in this case going to court. The one is Ipelaging Trust, and they owed for the 2 months to date 6.2 million. Gauteng Coaches is owed 2.1 million, and Patco is owed 153 million. They provide a service for 300,000 and have a workforce of 4,500. So just based on 2 months of return, November and December, those individual companies are owed that. And of course, there are 20, 30 other companies as well involved. So that's how it all adds up to this huge amount.
I just wanted to say, Chair, it is clear that there is a serious problem, and Treasury and the Department need to actually have our audience and actually explain a few things, and I don't see us getting anywhere without their input and urgent input. Thanks.
Okay. Where are we as a committee? One, we haven't heard the other parties and so on, and we apologize for that, but obviously. But can we at least agree as a committee as a first step now? Because the crisis, the next round of payments, never mind the ones that are backlogged, are due and may not be forthcoming. Our next chance to have a proper meeting with some of the other parties would be Tuesday, and I think we should resolve as a committee to do that. But the crisis might have hit us before then. So on the basis of the information, and for what it's worth, because we can only play a political role. We can't make the decision or order the executive to make the appropriate decision. Can we at least as a committee and across parties, and Stuart has indicated to me that in principle he's simple, can we as this committee urge Treasury and the National Department of Transport to urgently make at the very least some contingency arrangements, regardless of what court findings are and so on, because that's another process and so forth, regardless of further information, that in our judgment, on the basis of what we're hearing, and there's no reason to doubt, at least some of the basic things, that at the very least, urgent contingency arrangements must be made in the next days. And we would certainly urge, and certainly as ANC, and I hope we have the support from other parties, as the ANC here in Parliament, we strongly urge the two relevant departments to treat with great seriousness the crisis facing our people, commuters, workers, and so forth, and at the very least to make some immediate contingency arrangements, but with a view to having a sustainable solution, because contingency arrangements from 1 week to the next, or from 1 month to the next, was also not a solution for anybody. So does one have support for that? Okay, so we want to make a strong statement. Okay, pending then finding further things out. Okay. Now, and we're not blaming Treasury or the Department. We're not blaming anybody. We're just saying, let's not be in the blame game. Let's focus on a major problem which must be addressed. And on the basis of all the information we've got, which is what we've heard this morning, but also additionally what we've read all the time. I mean, I should say also I have interacted with at least two ministers who are affected by this and so forth. Okay. Hopefully this is happening in any case, but let's add whatever weight we carry as a committee to calling for this. Okay. So can we... Park that. Then I think we need to start then clarifying some of the other issues, which shouldn't, because contingency is one thing, and surely it's appropriate. But clearly then there are more structural and other things that we need to think about, and some of those have been flagged. And maybe we can take those one by one a little bit. although not allow them to distract us as we have a debate. And unfortunately, Stuart's gone, but one of the things that he said is that we must subsidize the passenger, the commuter, and not the operator. Okay. Now, and that's a debate, and we can have it, but I think that the position currently that we're moving towards, and certainly that's the one in the tendered contract, is that it's the operator that gets subsidized on the basis of a contractual agreement in terms of kilometers traveled. Okay, so the contracting authority, and what we're envisaging in the legislation that we're passing, is that by and large that we start to become metros and so on. We have an integrated transport plan, and according to that there would be contracts, which are competitive, you know, tendered contracts and so on, and then they would agree to subsidize or not, depending on what the agreement, but they might agree to subsidize, but that subsidy wouldn't be dependent on the number of people carried, but on the number of contractual kilometers traveled. That is the international, I think, best practice norm, if my understanding is right, because you want to ensure that a service is provided on a regular basis at hours, even at unpopular hours when there's not, you don't want to disincentivize providing a service at 11 o'clock at night or at 3 o'clock in the morning when there's a need for it, for instance. That's one of the things. Secondly, obviously increased passengers will add to the operator's costs if they have to supply extra vehicles and so on. But then those are extra kilometers that you're traveling. But let's not get too tangled up in that, but that's my understanding of why we're tending to move in that direction. Because the passenger thing is also opens up for potential abuse. You can monitor kilometers traveled more effectively than headcount, which is not to say that you can't do that. But anyway, that's the response. On minibuses, we're not now opening it up to minibuses in some random way. But we can't subsidize any public transport system unless it's part of a system and that you can monitor and regulate it. And we're battling on them. If minibus operators or any other kind of minibus operators or any, it's not about the mode, it's about providing a regulated, contracted service that you regulate as a public authority. And if it needs subsidy, you're able to subsidize it according to contractual arrangements. We don't have those arrangements with minibuses. And so our intention is to subsidize them operationally, but the trade-off for that is that they must be part of a regulated system, an effective regulated system. And so hopefully that's the answer to that aspect of what Stuart said. I think the answer to the other point he was making, putting the blame, and I don't want to get there too much, on the department, which can't do calculations and has run over budget and so on. I think we've got a clear explanation for that from Sitar, which is that there is a bit of guesswork because you don't know what the oil price is going to be, or spare parts prices, or all of those things are going to be. Because, and not least in the last year or so, it's been an incredibly fluctuating reality. And therefore, there has to be elasticity in these subsidy contracts. And I don't know that Treasury has failed to understand that, but insofar as they have, it's a problem, and they need to be made to understand that you can't operate in this environment unless there's that understanding. Okay. Those are the things I wanted to say. I don't know if the department wanted to say something.
No, that's good. I just wanted to just make a few general comments. One is in relation to the short-term crisis. It seems to me, and I don't deal with subsidies, but it seems to me it's something akin to a mini ESCOM type of disaster, where the economy is growing, the industry is growing, and you have in-migration factors. You have a cost push within the industry. And within that setup, the amount of resources that are actually being allocated for for that function, which is growing, is far beyond. And so I think that the Satao is absolutely correct. I have seen people who deal with subsidies within the department with the kind of frustrations that they've had in trying to obtain more resources for public transport. It has been a very difficult thing. And I think there is a definite need for that contingency approach on the one hand. But just with respect to the bill that you have passed as well, I think that will also allow for some of the structural change to occur. And this is more part of the medium to longer term. It's not going to assist the Satao or the industry now. But I would think that the issue of where the province dispenses the subsidies, but the planning actually takes place at the municipal sphere. Quite often we have spoken to a number of municipalities in the run-up to developing this bill, and they were saying that when they tell the province that, you know what, you need to be subsidizing this route and not the ones that you have been doing over the past years in terms of the apartheid routes, they have not been getting that kind of joy. So hopefully with the consolidation of the functions at the municipal sphere, including the planning, the regulation, as well as service provision, which includes the subsidies, all of the consolidation of those functions, maybe the municipality will be in a better position in future to actually, ensure that it's actually driven based on proper plans in terms of those ITPs.
You know, we all need to engage very intensively in debating and looking at the nitty-gritty of the future of public transport. There's a lot of work to be done by all of us. But just to pick up on a couple of comments that were made earlier. Firstly, on the question of the taxi industry, the question was raised, why haven't we in our submission said anything about the taxi industry? Well, we do also represent taxi workers. We've got taxi workers who are members of Satao. And so we do have a direct interest in the industry. But the reason that we don't, you know, mention the industry in this submission is that this crisis is really about the bus industry. How we solve the funding and sustainability of the taxi industry in the long term is a huge debate in and of itself. One of the problems of the taxi industry is that the transportation of people in small vehicles that cost a lot means that the sort of business model is not necessarily a very sustainable one. And so there are big questions about the long-term viability of the taxi industry in its current form, which I think is why the BRT system becomes really interesting as a mechanism for drawing the taxi industry into a system which is more financially viable and sustainable both for the owners and for the workers in the industry. But I should just mention that I had an SMS this morning on my way here from one of our organizers in the taxi industry in Johannesburg, saying that there is a mass meeting that has been called in Johannesburg on Sunday, I think it is, and our members are being offered money to, this is our taxi members, are being offered money to attend this meeting, and it seems that it is an attempt to mobilize a derailment of the Johannesburg BRT system. And this crisis in the bus industry just feeds right into the hands of that problem. So, you know, it's unfortunate that it's got to this point, because it creates potentially not just a crisis in the industry and for the commuters in the bus industry, but also potentially a further conflict of interest between the bus and the taxi industry at the very point where the legislation and the new systems that the metros are beginning to put in place are an attempt to draw the interests together. So it's really, really unfortunate that this has happened at the time that it has. And just to say that if there is some kind of contingency arrangement, you know, this is not about treasuries just or governments just being nice to the industry to bail it out, as was the case with SAA and with a whole lot of other cases. It's not about bailing out. It's about meeting a legal obligation that is written into contracts. And I think that's something that, that people really need to understand, that it's a really very different issue than the industry going with a begging bowl. It's actually saying, you government have entered into contracts with us. Now you must pay in line with those contracts. How the contracts change in the future and how the industry reshapes itself with the support and design of government is really another question, an important question and linked to the current crisis. But the you know, the intervention that is needed now is actually to say, look, these are contracts that have been signed and government must meet its obligations.
Okay,
no, Chair, I just wanted to say that we are done, and we have agreed on a position that we had as a committee on this particular matter, and also further action to engage the department and to actually hear their side of story. And I think it makes sense. And
let's try to clarify a position, which is a provisional position. I mean, what we're clear about is we're saying there must be some urgent attention from government and intervention, which could be of a contingency kind. We agree that contingency isn't a sustainable thing, but at the very least. The reason why I'm using contingency, one is we've not heard the other parties. Two, it's subject to court cases of one kind or another, and presumably the government's position or Treasury's position in these court cases is they're not valid contracts or there's something about them and so on. So I hear your argument, and that presumably would be, you know, it's, obviously it may well be upheld by the courts, but I don't want to venture into that, which is why I'm saying quite apart from what happens in the courts, however they might find, we've got a social and political social problem here. We've got to address it with a sense of great urgency. First step, something's got to happen in the next few days, even if it's just an interim measure. Secondly, I think provisionally, after having heard further things, insofar as there's a concern about the current ability of provinces, for instance, to effectively monitor the contracts that we've got, whether I personally suspect that we are spending too much in terms of maybe be spending more than we need to or on subsidizing public transport, because we're subsidizing irrational systems which are often undermining each other. I'd be happy for us to subsidize this much more, but what I'm saying is a lot of the expenses we're supporting competing modes, both of whom are capturing ridership from each other, and then we're trying to recapitalize another sector, which is hand to mouth, the taxi industry, which is also then competing instead of having integrated systems. So we agree whether in terms of the ability to monitor that there might be shortcomings, that there might be loopholes that are being exploited. So that's not the sitar with particularly the position, but that, you know, it may or may not be the case. And we agree that the whole thing needs to be cleaned up, which is one of the reasons why we've been taking a lot of time with this thing. So we agree on that there are arguments that could be posed from all sides, but while the arguments are going on, that's a luxury, there's a big problem which has to be addressed. But then we need to address the systemic issues, the architecture and so forth, which we're trying to do in legislation, and therefore I think our message provisionally to the department is please show a great deal of urgency on the restructuring that has to happen. We're not saying you're not, but please do that, because that, insofar as there's a debate going on between yourself and the Treasury, the greater determination that you show to implement rational transformation in the direction that we all agree on, the better argument we can put up for the funding coming through. Okay, can we then, sort of on that note, unless there's anything else to add for the moment, adjourn. We'll try to we'll ask for the Department of Transport in particular and Treasury to come on Tuesday. We can think about whether we want to get tangled up with Saboa, for instance, as well on that occasion. Maybe we should, but we'll certainly try to meet at the next possible opportunity that we have as a committee. Jane, you want to hear the second?
Sorry, Chair, I'm sorry to ask you again for the floor, but I just want to make one point, and that is, you know, you raised the possibility that possibly government is reluctant because they are challenging the validity of the contract. In the GABS case, and so far in this case that's running in Gauteng, there's no indication that either the Department of Transport or Treasury is questioning the validity of the contract. Their argument is purely based on the fact that there is no allocation from Treasury for the money. So the validity of the contract to date has not been challenged in any shape or form.
Okay, can we then meet on that note? Wish you best of luck and thanks for coming. And I think it was important for you, Parliament, to raise that. Okay, so we'll do this in the House tomorrow.